wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, I was joined by AUT Professor Marcus Jones. We spoke about the search for people who never get COVID, what COVID vaccines for young kids could mean for the pandemic, as well as the common antidepressant that slashes the risk of COVID-19 deaths. Lots of COVID stuff, but all very interesting. So we began by talking about the first topic, how an international team of researchers are wanting to find people who don't get COVID.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, we've got a sort of a day of COVID topics. Given the lockdown situation in Auckland, it seems appropriate. But the first topic is about the possibility of finding people who are naturally resistant to COVID, never having to worry about contracting COVID-19 or spreading the virus. Now, this isn't, you know, I caught COVID and I didn't get any symptoms, because you've still been infected and you can still pass it on. This is people who couldn't catch COVID at all due to some sort of genetic difference in these people makes them naturally resistant. And it's quite likely that these people exist. And there's a research group in the States who is trying to find them. And they're trying to enroll them in a study because they want to find what is the genetic modification, what makes them genetically resistant to COVID. And the team hopes that identifying the genes that are protecting these individuals could lead to, again, more virus-blocking drugs that not only protect people from COVID, but also prevent them from passing on the infection. Now, success isn't guaranteed. This might be quite a hard thing to do. There may only be a handful of people with this trait worldwide. And the question is how to find them. So they've got a few strategies to do this. And they seem to be quite confident about tracking some people down. So the first step to narrow the search to people who have been exposed without protection to a sick person over an extended period and have not ever tested positive or mounted any sort of an immune response against the virus, because if they weren't infected at all, then they wouldn't have any positive tests or any immune response. And a particular interest of people who shared a home or a bed or whatever with an infected partner, and these pairs are known as a discordant couple. So one person in the couple is sick with COVID and the other person just says no thank you.
Yeah,
that's right. His body says no.
Yes.
So these authors of the study have already recruited 500 potential candidates who might fit that criteria, and they published a paper a few weeks ago, and then another 600 people emerged as a result of that, including some from Russia and India, and they've contacted them, nominating themselves as possible candidates. And the goal is to have at least 1,000 recruits so they can test, well, did they actually really not contract COVID? Were they really exposed to COVID? And things like that. So it's a difficult task because it's difficult to prove that candidates were highly exposed to the virus. And they'll have to confirm that the sick person was shedding high doses of live virus when the couple were interacting closely with one another. Certainly discordant couples are not uncommon, but it's rare to find those that meet these criteria and also have been regularly tested. And the fact that many people have now been vaccinated, potentially masking any genetic resistance to the virus, further limits the pool of people to study. So these are people who are, at the time at least, haven't been vaccinated, you know, because otherwise the vaccine could be responsible for the lack of infection.
Yeah, and what does this mean?
The researchers are going to compare the people's genomes with those of people who have been infected and in search of genes associated with resistance. And any contender genes will be studied in cell and animal models to confirm causal link to resistance and try to establish, well, what is the mechanism of action? How is this genetic change causing resistance to COVID? And there's been rare mutations that have previously been identified that make people more susceptible to COVID, but these researchers that are also now shifting gears from susceptibility to resistance. So we know there are genes that make people more susceptible, so we need to find the genes that make people less susceptible.
Right.
And so there's several mechanisms that people are thinking about. The most obvious could be that some people just don't have a functioning ACE2 receptor, and these are the receptors that the COVID virus uses to enter the cells. And so if people have some sort of non-functioning receptor due to some genetic change, then that could stop COVID infection. And this type of mechanism has previously been observed with HIV, which is the virus behind AIDS. And in the beginning of the 90s, there was work that had helped to identify a rare mutation that disables the CCR5 receptor on white blood cells, which prevents HIV from entering them. So it's a similar sort of mechanism. So this is not unprecedented. Other people may just have a very powerful immune response, especially in the cells lining the inside of their noses. Some people might have mutations that ramp up genes that stop the virus from replicating and repackaging into new viral particles, or that break down the viral RNA in cells. So there's various different mechanisms, various different ways this could work, and we just have to find the genetic mutations that could cause that.
Yeah. Wow. And yeah, I mean, speaking of people who, you know, never get COVID, maybe that could be young kids if they get the COVID vaccine.
That's right.
Yeah, could you tell me a bit about this second topic, what COVID vaccines for young kids could mean for the pandemic?
Well, this is very topical. I think a lot of parents of young children are very concerned that they may have to start sending their kids back to school unvaccinated because there isn't and yet an approved vaccine for children aged 5 to 11. But the good news, at least the good news right now for people in the States, is that the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. has authorized COVID-19 vaccine for the roughly 28 million 5 to 11-year-olds who live in the United States. And this decision comes after an agency advisory committee reviewed data from a clinical trial testing a low-dose version of the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, which is the one we have in New Zealand, on children in that age group, and voted nearly unanimously to recommend the FDA grant emergency approval.
Right. So the benefits outweigh the risks or concerns.
Yes. And it's likely to save lives in that age group. Modelers suggest that it could save lives of children between 5 and 11. And in the U.S., children aged 5 to 11 have returned to school unvaccinated in the past few months. And that group now accounts for a significant proportion of new COVID-19 cases. And they're capable of transmitting those infections, obviously, to others. So for every child's life that you save, you may actually save many, many more adult lives because the children obviously bring home COVID and then transmit that to their families. And the benefits, it seems, outweigh the risks. So the FDA advisory panel voted in favor of approving this on the basis of clinical trial data that showed that the Pfizer vaccine is about 91% effective at preventing symptomatic SARS infection in 5 to 11-year-olds. About 4,500 children participated in the trial, and nearly two-thirds received vaccine doses that were about a third of that of an adult jab, and the others received a placebo. And in a procedure similar to that used to vaccinate adults with a messenger RNA jab in the United States, kids received two doses that were 3 weeks apart. So it's the same sort of protocol that the adults have, but the dose is just reduced. And for the children tested, the data show that the vaccine is safe. It's known that mRNA vaccines, mRNA-based vaccines, which is what the Pfizer vaccine is, have been linked to a very, very small risk of myocarditis, which is the inflammation of the heart muscle, and pericarditis, which is an inflammation of the lining around the heart, particularly in young men. And I stress this is a very, very small risk. But in the test group, there were no reports of either condition in the 5 to 11-year-olds involved in the trial. Now, if the shot was distributed to larger populations, regulators would need to watch for any sign of that side effect, but there's no sign yet. And so the FDA, in their review, said really the benefits clearly outweigh the risks. And officials determined that even if the virus levels were very low across the country, the overall benefits of the vaccine would probably still outweigh the potential risks of heart problems because these conditions typically resolve in a few days after vaccination, unlike obviously COVID-19, which can cause death. Now, SARS-CoV-2 is not nearly as lethal in younger people as in older ones. Around 440 children aged 5 to 18 have died of COVID-19 in the United States, compared with around 724,000 in all age groups. But the combination of kids returning to classrooms and a surge caused by the Delta variant has resulted in a sharp rise in pediatric cases beginning in the States in late July. So of the 6.3 million U.S. children who have tested positive for COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic, about a third were diagnosed in the 11 weeks up to the 21st of October this year. So the question is, you know, when are we going to get it here? And I think there are a few hurdles that we have to jump through in New Zealand to get this drug here. Now, there are some countries that have already begun inoculating kids with various, I mean, by kids, I mean 5 to 11-year-olds with various COVID-19 vaccines in the last 3 months. So Chile, China, Cuba, and the United Arab Emirates have already begun doing this. But in places where the population has a very low natural immunity, such as New Zealand, because the virus transmission has remained very low throughout the pandemic, then this vaccine, the people in the study say this vaccine will be essential. Australia, for example, is planning to reopen its international borders in November, allowing citizens and permanent residents to leave and enter the country if the vaccination rate in their state of residence has hit 80%. And that's 80% of the total population rather than of the eligible population. And if that is the case, then that move will effectively invite the virus into Australia, and it will be essential to soften the landing as much as possible by building up people's immunity through vaccination, and that really includes children. And I think that's the same here. We have to build up our immunity in New Zealand because we don't really have any natural immunity, unlike countries where there have been, you know, gigantic numbers of cases.
Yeah, that's super fascinating, and I wish we could actually talk about this in a bit more detail, but now we've got our third topic. Could you tell me a bit more about this, the common antidepressant that slashes the risk of COVID death? I want to say fluvoxamine?
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, this has just come out that a pretty cheap and widely available drug that's used to treat mental illness has been found to cut both the risk of death from COVID-19 and the need for people with disease to receive intensive medical care. According to recent trial results. And the drug is called fluvoxamine. It's taken for conditions including depression and obsessive compulsive disorder. And it's also known to dampen immune responses and temper tissue damage. And researchers credit these properties with its success in the recent trials. So among study participants who took the drug as directed and did so in the early stages of the disease, COVID-19-related deaths fell by roughly 90%, which seems pretty huge, and
wow,
the need for intensive COVID-19-related medical care fell by roughly 65%. So you're less likely to die, and you're less likely to need intensive care. And the study included about 1,500 people in Brazil who had COVID-19 and were at high risk of severe disease. Roughly half received fluvoxamine, and the rest received a placebo. And these results were published on the 27th of October, so only a few days ago. And so it means that fluvoxamine is one of a handful of therapies that show strong evidence of preventing progression from mild to severe COVID-19. The only early stage treatments currently recommended by the U.S. National Institutes of Health are monoclonal antibodies, which are costly and difficult to administer. I think this is what the Donald Trump had last year when he got sick. And they're very, very costly and difficult to administer. But fluvoxamine's low cost could make it accessible worldwide. It is already available in New Zealand. This is a drug that is approved in New Zealand for use. A 10-day course costs only about $4, so that's about $6.
Oh, wow, that is cheap.
So not a lot, yeah. And the drug's patents have all expired, meaning that any company can produce it. It is possible that pairing fluvoxamine with a drug that interferes with viral replication, such as Merck's upcoming antiviral, now this is a hard one, molnupiravir.
Oh my goodness, I had an issue with this the other week, and yeah, I think you did it, molnupiravir.
I think something like that. And this is the drug that the New Zealand government have already talked about because they've purchased about 60,000 courses of that molnupiravir drug in October. And so it's possible this fluvoxamine combined with that could give even better protection against the disease. But this is sort of early days. They need to work out exactly how to do it and what doses and things like that. But I think this is a very positive step.
That was AUT Professor Marcus Jones speaking with me on this week's Dear Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.